dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On November 4th, the American electorate resoundingly repudiated the policies of the Bush years and sent Barack Obama and his party to office with a mandate for change. How shall change be achieved, and what shall it be? This election is historic in many ways, but how it plays out is yet to be seen. History is strewn with the carcasses of failed attempts to break the backs of oligarchies, yet there have also been moments of progress. History is a great teacher in this regard, because the truth has a way of emerging sooner or later, often very much later. In his acceptance speech, Barack Obama spoke of placing our hands on the arc of history and bending it toward a better future. He stated truthfully that his election is not the change we seek, but the opportunity to make it. The changes so many are seeking threaten powerful interests, and history is littered with the bodies of failed saviors in whose person too much hope was invested. I chose to read you Susan Rosenthal's book, Power and Powerlessness, to provide a systemic context to this election season. The book has, to this point, been showing how the powerlessness of the many has been created in order to vest power in a few. This week, we'll continue with Chapter 12 at the end of the program, but we'll begin by hearing from the preeminent people's historian, Howard Zinn, with a brand new talk given November 8th in Binghamton, New York, that addresses just these questions: change, the power to make it, the role of movements, and the role of the state. It's one of his best from someone wise, brave, and with a long view.
My name is Carol Linsky, and I am an activist historian. I am honored to be the delegate among so many wonderful, smart, and caring students who put this thing together. Yeah. And I am welcoming you to SUNY's first ever social justice conference. All right. Woo! All right. I hope you've had a wonderful time forging contacts and getting to know each other and telling everybody about the work that your groups and your organizations have been doing for human rights and peace in our time. We need to generate community-wide support for our visions because there is a lot of work to be done. We've asked Professor Howard Zinn to come and join us on this occasion because he understands what we're trying to do. He writes about the use of history to cultivate that the use of history to cultivate hero worship really just lets us down. It creates a master narrative, he says, that gives us an easy acceptance of atrocities like mass murder, mass incarceration, mass neglect, and they're justified as the deplorable consequences of but necessary for the price of progress. We must not only change how we achieve progress, but what we mean by progress. By looking at history from below, Zinn writes about the people, those among us who have not waited for somebody else to take care of our problems, but we have mustered up the courage to make history for ourselves. The election this past week is indeed a harbinger of possibilities and potentialities. Yeah, hell yeah. But, you know, Even the best presidents need people on the ground to take care of business on a local level. Yes. As most of us celebrate the historical significance of Barack Obama's presidential election, we should remember that we live in troublous and uncertain times. On this weekend, we realize our work is just beginning. We cannot stop now. Many sponsors have given from Binghamton University and the local community have graciously provided this forum to forge contacts and share ideas. Thank you. Thank you. That's a lot of work. Thanks. We should take advantage of this opportunity to begin to create a SUNY system statewide that cultivates an egalitarian relationship between administrators, groups, and individuals. Our problems might be difficult, but if we continue to come together with the spirit of community, we will be able to see the fruits of our labors. I hope that university administrators begin to engage with students responsively so that together we can find just solutions to the issues that trouble us on our campus and in our community. I believe that Howard Zinn's presentation will help every one of us to see the university and our respective communities from the point of view of students, faculty, staff who do the work here, and the residents who live and work here near and among us. We're all in this together. A little brief history lesson, since I'm a historian. In 1896, the same year the Supreme Court sanctioned the racist separate but unequal doctrine, Sarah Dudley Petty, a black woman from North Carolina, wrote, "There is an old adage, nevertheless a true one, that justice slumbers but never sleeps. Oftentimes in slumbering, merit lies unrewarded for a time." Well, tonight in Binghamton, New York, justice is awake. All right. Now let me introduce you, Professor of History, Herbert Bix, and he will introduce our speaker, Professor Howard Zinn. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. It's a wonderful honor that we have Howard with us. He's exerted the deepest influence on my life. I consider him my mentor and friend. And if you want, you history and sociology students in the audience and everyone else who wants the finest expression of Howard's philosophy of history, go read The Politics of History. Howard.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I didn't expect such an enthusiastic welcome. I didn't know what to expect. That was a very rousing introduction from Professor Linsky. You don't expect that from a historian. Those aren't the kind of historians I used to hang out with. Very subdued and dignified and so low-key you didn't hear them. So that was really nice to see. And Herb Bix, my old friend, one of the reasons I came here. You think I came here to make a speech? No, I came here to see an old friend, and you just happened to be here. So, since I'm here, I may as well speak. May even speak on the topic that I'm supposed to speak about, which is war and social justice. Did you know that's what I'm going to speak about? Well, it doesn't matter. That's what I'm going to speak about, whether you like it or not. Okay? I don't know if you noticed it in the recent presidential campaign. War was not number one on the agenda of the presidential candidates. Did you notice that? It wasn't. It sort of was there in the background. Oh, yeah, there's a little war going on. Oh, yeah, there are two wars going on. But we'll talk about something else. We'll talk about economic issues. We'll talk about, well, remember, that's what the candidates talked about, right? They talked about health and the reform, and they talked about taxation, and you know, they talk about economic troubles and things like that, you know? And somehow, you know, the war was missing in a campaign. And the question is, you know, why? And I think one reason is that it's easier to talk about issues of social justice, especially if what you talk about is not really concrete. If things are complicated and ambiguous, if both candidates present health plans which the average person cannot really easily distinguish one from the other. So easier to do that, easier to talk about that. But I want to talk about social justice, and I want to talk about war, and I want to talk about the connection between the two. And my starting point for talking about social justice is to ask, well, you know, what really would constitute social justice, or what would constitute a real agenda for social justice? And this is not something that the candidates used as their criteria. I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You may know that this year is the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1948, a few years after the end of World War II. Eleanor Roosevelt was very, very important in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And if you get a chance, take a look at it. It's not hard to find it, right? Google. Google is the answer to everything. Yeah, Google the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You'll see the many, many parts of it. But fundamentally, what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, and, well, you go right to number 25, right? And it'll say that everybody on the planet has a right to housing, health, food, health care, education. Everybody on the planet has an equal right to all of those things. Well, that's a tall order. In order to achieve that, you'd have to go a long way from where we are. And you'd have to suggest a lot more bolder programs than were suggested by either of the two candidates. I know you may be wondered why I keep talking about the two candidates almost as if they were both doing the same thing. They weren't exactly doing the same thing, no. And Obama was saying more and better than McCain. And well, there are many reasons why Obama was preferable to McCain. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. But I think both of them fell short, as far as I was concerned, of what they should be doing. But you see, I'm not a politician, right? And it's not the job of the citizen to be a politician. The politician may think that he must moderate and must be careful and must stop short here and stop short there. The citizen should not be doing that. The citizen should not confuse himself, herself, about being a citizen or a politician. The citizen should speak out fully, boldly, clearly on exactly what the citizen thinks is the truth. And then if the candidate is a politician, you know, wants to play with that because it's politically useful, okay, that's their problem. But we, as citizens, have to simply speak our minds. We mustn't be deflected from what we consider to be the truth by the sort of political opportunism and of candidates, what they perceive is a politically necessary thing to do. So, yes, I think our test for social justice should be the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everybody entitled to total health care, free education, food, housing, everybody, you see. Oh, by the way, just as a little aside on social justice, I think I will sort of anticipate what might be a question in a question period and get it out of the way now so I don't have to deal with it later. I anticipate that at some point in a question period, somebody will say to me, well, but what do we do? It always comes up. Why? Because the speaker is speaking in grandiose terms. I always speak in grandiose terms. The speaker is speaking, you know, about larger things. The speaker speaking about the world and the nation and war and peace and all of these really important issues. But the person sitting in the audience saying, okay, enough. But what shall I do? You know, what can I do? So I'm anticipating that question and trying to deal with it now. Because my answer is usually, look around you. Look around you in the community. Look around you in the university. Look around you wherever you are. See what's going on. See who's having a problem. Is there an immigrant having a problem? Is there a person having a problem with the police? You know, is there an environmental issue that's come up because some industry has polluted the environment? Look around you. Is somebody being fired unnecessarily? Is somebody being paid lower than minimum wages? Or maybe they're just being paid minimum wages, which are bad enough, right? So that's the kind of thing. And then as I was coming here, or as I was talking to people before coming here, they said, well, you know what's happening on campus, that the food workers are having trouble. Did you know that? The food workers are having trouble with getting their contract renewed because they want to get more than $6 or $7 or $8 an hour. They can't take care of a family on that. Well, there's an issue for you right here. You don't have to go far. You don't have to, you know, right? We all should be helping people around us who need help. It's called solidarity. That's what solidarity is. Yeah. You know, why is all the political rhetoric limited? Why is the set of solutions given to social and economic issues so cramped and so short of what is needed, so short of what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights demands? And so Obama, who obviously is more attuned to the needs of people than his opponent. Obama, who is more farsighted, more thoughtful, more imaginative, why has he been limited in what he is saying? Why hasn't he come out for what is called a single-payer system in healthcare? You all know what the single-payer system is. It's a sort of awkward term for it, maybe. It doesn't explain what it means, but a single-payer health system means, well, it'll be sort of run like Social Security. It'll be a government system. It won't depend on intermediaries, on middle people, on insurance companies. You won't have to fill out forms and pay, figure out whether you have a pre-existing medical condition. You won't have to go through that rigmarole which has kept 40 million people out of having health insurance. No. Something happens, you just go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, you're taken care of. Period. The government will pay for it. Yeah, the government will pay for it. That's what governments are for. Governments are, you know. They do that for the military. Do you know that? That's what the military has. The military has free insurance. I was once in the military. I got pneumonia, which is easier to get in the military. I got pneumonia. I didn't have to fool around with deciding what health plan I'm in or what the, you know. No, I was totally taken care of. I didn't have to think about money. Just, you know, there's a million members of the armed forces who have that. But when you ask that the government do this for everybody else, they cry, that's socialism. Well, if that's socialism, it must mean socialism is good. Right? You know, I was really gratified when Obama called for let's tax the rich more and let's tax the poor and middle class less. And he said, that's socialism. And I thought, whoa, I'm happy to hear that. Finally, socialism is getting a good name, you know. You know, socialism has been given bad names, you know, Stalin and all those socialists, so-called socialists. They weren't really socialists, but, you know, they called themselves socialists, but they weren't really, you see. And so socialism got a bad name. It used to have a really good name. Here in the United States, the beginning of the 20th century, before there was a Soviet Union to spoil it, you see, socialism had a good name. Millions of people in the United States read socialist newspapers. They elected socialist members of Congress and socialist members of state legislatures. You know, there were like 14 socialist chapters in Oklahoma. Really? I mean, socialism. Who stood for socialism? Eugene Debs, Helen Keller, Emma Goldman, you know, Clarence Darrow, Jack London, Upton Sinclair. Yeah, socialism had a good name. It needs to be restored. And so, but Obama, with all of his goodwill, intelligence, all those qualities that he has, and so on, you feel that he has a certain instinct for people in trouble, but still, you know, he wouldn't come out for a single-payer health system. That is for what I would call health security, to go along with social security, you see. Wouldn't come out for that. Come out for the government creating jobs for millions of people, because that's what really is needed now. You see, when the newspapers this morning report highest unemployment in decades, right? The government needs to create jobs. Private enterprise is not going to create jobs. Private enterprise fails. The so-called free market system fails again and again. When the Depression hit in the 1930s, Roosevelt and the New Deal created jobs. Millions of people. There were people on the, you know, out there on the fringe who yelled, socialism. Didn't matter. People needed it. If people need something badly and somebody does something for them, you can throw all the names you want at them. It won't matter, you see. But that was needed in this campaign. Yes. Instead of Obama and McCain joining together, I know some of you are maybe annoyed that I'm being critical of Obama, but that's my job. That's a citizen, you know. I like him, I'm for him, I want him to do well, I'm happy he won, I'm delighted he won, but I'm a citizen. I have to speak my mind, okay? Yeah. And, you know, but when I saw Obama and McCain sort of both together supporting the $700 billion bailout, I thought, uh-oh, No, no, please don't do that. Please, Obama, step aside from that. Do what... I'm sure something in your instincts must tell you that there's something wrong with giving $700 billion to the same financial institutions which ruined us. We got us into this mess. Something wrong with that, you see. And it's not even politically viable. That is, it's, you can't even say, oh, I'm doing it because people will then vote for me. No. It was very obvious when the $700 billion bailout was announced that the majority of people in the country were opposed to it. Instinctively, they said, something is wrong with this. Why give it to them? We need it. That's what the government, Obama should have been saying. No, let's take that $700 billion. Let's give it to people who can't pay their mortgages. Let's create jobs, you know. And, you know, instead of pouring $700 billion into the top, and hoping that it will trickle down to the bottom. No, go right to the bottom where people need it. So, yes, that was a disappointment. So I'm trying to indicate what we'll have to do now to fulfill what Obama himself has promised, change, real change. You can say change, but if you keep doing the old policies, it's not change, right? So what stands in the way of Obama and the Democratic Party, and what stands in the way of them really going all out for a social and economic program that will fulfill the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Well, I can think of two things that stand in the way. Maybe there are more, but I can only think of two things at a time. One of them is simply the great, powerful economic interests that don't want real economic change. Really, they don't. Powerful, I mean, you take in health care. There are powerful interests involved in the present health care system. People are making lots of money from the health care system as it is, making so much money, and that's why the costs of the health care system in the United States are double what the health care costs are. The percentage, you know, of money devoted to health care percentage is double administrative costs in the United States compared to countries that have the single-payer system, because there are people there who is siphoning off this money, who are making money. Their health plans, their insurance companies, their health executives and CEOs, so that there are, their interests, economic interests that are in the way of real economic change. And Obama so far has not challenged those economic interests. Roosevelt did challenge those economic interests boldly, right frontally. He called them economic royalists. He wasn't worried that people would say, oh, you're appealing to class conflict, you know, the kind of thing they pull out all the time, as if there isn't, hasn't always been class conflict. It's something new, you know, class conflict. You're creating class conflict. We've never had class conflict. We've always all been one happy family. You know, no. There are these interests standing, you know, in the way. And, you know, unfortunately, the Democratic Party is tied to many of those interests. Democratic Party is tied to a lot of corporate interests. I mean, you look at the people who are on Obama's economics team, and they're Goldman Sachs people, and they're former, you know, people like that, you know. That's not, they don't represent change. They represent the old style democratic stay put leadership. It's not good. So the other factor that stands in the way of a real, bold economic and social program is the war. The war. The thing that, a $600 billion military budget. Now, how can you call for the government to take over the healthcare system? How can you call for the government to give jobs to millions of people? How can you do all that? How can you offer free education, free higher education, which is what we should have, really? We should have free higher education. Well, how can you, how can you double teacher salaries? And how can you do all these things which will do away with poverty in the United States? It all costs money. Where's that money going to come from? Well, it can come from two sources. One is the tax structure. Here Obama been moving in the right direction. When he talked about not giving the rich tax breaks and giving tax breaks to the poor, in the right direction, but not far enough. Because the top 1% of the richest 1% of the country has gained several trillions of dollars in the last 20, 30 years as a result of the tax system, which has favored them. And, you have a tax system where 200 of the richest corporations pay no taxes. You know that? You can't do that. You don't have their accountants. You don't have their legal teams and so on and so forth. You don't have their loopholes. The war, $600 billion. We need that. We need that money. But in order to say that, we're going to increase taxes on the super rich much more than Obama has proposed. And believe me, it won't make those people poor. They'll still be rich. They just won't be super rich. I don't care if there's some rich people around. But we don't need super rich, not when that money is needed to take care of little kids in preschool and there's no money for preschool. No. We need a radical change in the tax structure, which will immediately free huge amounts of money to do the things that need to be done, and then we have to get money from the military budget. Well, how do you get money from the military budget? Don't we need $600 billion for the military budget? And don't we have to fight two wars? No. We don't have to fight any wars. And this is where Obama and the Democratic Party have been hesitant, to talk about. But we're not hesitant to talk about it. The citizens should not be hesitant to talk about it. If the citizens are hesitant to talk about it, they will just reinforce the Democratic leadership and Obama in their hesitations. we have to speak what we believe is the truth. And I think the truth is we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. These wars are absurd. They're horrible. Also, they're horrible and they're absurd. From a human point of view, they're horrible. The deaths and the mangled limbs and the blindness and the 3 million people in Iraq losing their homes, having to leave their homes. 3 million people. Imagine having to look elsewhere to live because of our occupation. Because of our war for democracy, our war for liberty, our war for whatever it is we're supposed to be fighting for. No, we don't need. We need a president who will say, "Yeah, I'm giving advice to Obama. I know he's listening." But if enough people speak up, he will listen, right? If enough people speak up, he will listen. No, there's much more of a chance of him listening, right, than those other people. They're not listening. They wouldn't listen. Obama could possibly listen if we, all of us, and the thing to say is, we have to change our whole attitude as a nation towards war, militarism, violence. We have to declare that we are not going to engage in aggressive wars. We are going to renounce the Bush doctrine of preventive war. Oh, we have to go to, you know. We have to go to war on this little pitiful country, because this little pitiful country might someday do what? Attack us? I mean, Iraq might attack us? Well, they're developing a nuclear weapon, one, which they may have in 5 or 10 years. That's what all the experts said, even the experts on the government side. You know, they may develop one nuclear weapon in 5 years. Wow. The United States has 10,000 nuclear weapons. Nobody says, how about us? You know all about that. Weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. No reason for us to wage aggressive wars. We have to renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy. We save a lot of money. We have to dismantle the military bases we have all over the world. You know, we have this peace-loving country has troops in 100 different countries in the world. 100 different countries, we have military bases. That doesn't look like a peace-loving country. And besides, I mean, first of all, of course, it's very expensive. We save a lot of money. Do we really need those bases? What do we need those bases for? I can't figure out what we need those bases for. So we have to give that up. And we have to declare ourselves a peaceful nation. We will no longer be a military superpower. Oh, that's terrible. There are people who think we must be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military power at all, you see. We can be a humanitarian superpower. We'll still be powerful, we'll still be rich, but we're going to use that power and that wealth to help people all over the world. I mean, instead of sending helicopters to bomb people, send helicopters when they face a hurricane or an earthquake and they desperately need helicopters. There's a lot of money available once you seriously, fundamentally change the foreign policy of the United States. Now, Obama has been hesitant to do that. And it has something to do with a certain mindset, because it doesn't have anything to do really with politics, that is with, more votes. Do you think most Americans know that we have bases in 100 countries? I'll bet you if you took a poll and asked among the American people, how many countries do you think we have bases in? Now, I don't know exactly what the answer is in, but I would guess, there'd be like 5, 10. But I think most people would be surprised. In other words, there isn't a public demanding that we have bases in 100 countries, so there's no political advantage to that. Well, of course, there's economic advantage to corporations that supply those bases and build those bases and make profit from those bases, But I do believe that the American people would welcome a president who said, we are not going to wage aggressive war anymore. The American people are not war-minded people. They become war-minded when a president gets up there and creates an atmosphere of hysteria and fear and, you know, and says, well, we must go to war. Then people without thinking about it, why are we bombing Afghanistan? Because, Osama bin Laden is there. Where? Well, they don't really know. So we'll bomb the country. You know, if we bomb the country, maybe we'll get them. You see? Sure, in the process, thousands of Afghans will die, right? But so people didn't have time to stop and think. But the American people are not war-minded people. They would welcome, I believe, a turn away from war. So there's no real political advantage to that. But it has to do with a mindset, a certain mindset that, that a lot of Americans have, and that Obama, obviously, and the Democratic leadership, Pelosi and Harry Reid and the others, that they all still have. And when you talk about a mindset that they have, which stands in the way of the declaring against war, you're reminded that during the campaign, I don't know if you remember this, that at one point Obama said, and you know, there were many times in the campaign where he said really good things if he'd only followed up on them, you see, and if he only follows up on them now. But at one point in the campaign, he said, it's not just a matter of getting out of Iraq. It's a matter of changing the mindset that got us into Iraq, you see. That was a very important statement. Unfortunately, he has not followed through by changing his mindset, you see. He knows somewhere in, and he expressed it, that we have to change our mindset, but he hasn't done it. Why? I don't know. It's because there are too many people around him and too many forces around him, and et cetera, that, but no, that mindset is still there. So I want to talk about what that mindset is, what the elements of that mindset are. And I have to look at my watch. Not that it matters. Not that I care. But, you know, I feel conscience stricken over keeping you here just to hear the truth. But here are some of the elements of the mindset that stand in the way for Obama, in the way for the Democratic Party, in the way for many Americans, in the way for us. And one of the elements in a mindset is the idea, somehow, that the United States is exceptional. In the world of the social science and, you know, that discipline called social science, there's actually a phrase for it. It's called American exceptionalism. And what it means is the idea that the United States is unique in the world, you know, that we are different, that we, not just different, we're better, right? We are better than other people. Our society is better than other society. This is a very dangerous thing to think. When you become so arrogant that you think you are better and different than other countries in the world, then that gives you a carte blanche to do nasty things. You can do nasty things because you're better. You're justified in doing those things because, yeah, we're different. What's that? I haven't heard that phrase since 1968. But it shows that progress is not lost. So we have to divest ourselves of the idea that, you know, we are somehow better, and, you know, we are the city on the hill, which is what the first governor of Massachusetts, Tom Winthrop, said. Reagan also said that. Reagan said lots of things, you know. Everybody looks to... No, we're an empire, like other empires. There was the British Empire, and there was the Russian Empire, there was the German Empire, and the Japanese Empire, and the French, and the Belgian Empire, the Dutch Empire, and the Spanish Empire, and now there's the American Empire, and our empire. And when we look at those empires, we say, oh, imperialism. But our empire, no. Yeah, there was one sort of scholar who wrote in the New York Times, he said, we are an empire light. Light? Tell that to the people of Iraq. Tell that to the people in Afghanistan. Now, you know, we are an empire light? No, we are heavy. All you have to do is look at our history, and you'll see, no, our history does not show a beneficent country doing good all over the world. Our history shows expansion. It shows us, it shows us moving into doubling our territory with the Louisiana Purchase, which I remember on our schoolroom maps looked very benign. Oh, there's all that empty land, and now we have it. It wasn't empty. There were people living there. There were Indian tribes. Hundreds of Indian tribes were living there. You see, and if it's going to be ours, we've got to get rid of them. And we did. We instigate a war with Mexico in 1846 to 1848. At the end of the war, we take almost half of Mexico. You know, and why? We wanted that land. That's very simple. We want things. There's a drive of nations that have the power and the capacity to bully other nations, a tendency to expand into the areas that those other nations have. We see it all over the world. And the United States has done that again and again. And, you know, and then we expanded into the Caribbean, and then we expanded out into the Pacific with Hawaii and the Philippines. And of course, you know, in the 20th century, expanding our influence in Europe, in Asia, and now in the Middle East, everywhere. An expansionist country, an imperialist power. For what? To do good things for these other people? Or is it because we coveted? When I say we, I don't mean to include you and me. But I've gotten, you know, they've gotten us so used to identifying with the government. You know, like I say, we, like the janitor at General Motors says, we. No. No, the CEO of General Motors and the janitor are not we. We're not. Exceptionalism is one part of the mindset we have to get rid of. We have to see ourselves honestly for what we are. We're an empire like other empires. We're as aggressive and brutal and violent as the Belgians were in the Congo, as the British were in India, and all these other empires. Yeah, we're just like them. We have to face it. When you face that, you sober up a little, and then you don't think you can just go all over the world and say, oh, we're doing this for liberty and democracy. Because then if you know your history, you know how many times that was said. Oh, we're going into the Philippines to bring civilization and Christianity to the Filipinos. We're going to bring civilization to the Mexicans, et cetera, et cetera. No. You'll understand that. That's one element in this mindset. And that, of course, when you say this, when you say these things, when you go back into the history, when you try to give an honest recounting of what we have been, not we really, what the government has done, our government has done. People haven't done it. The government does these things, and then they try to include us and involve us in their criminal conspiracy. You know, we didn't do this, but they're dragooning us into this. But when you start criticizing, when you start making an honest assessment of what we have done in the world, they say you're being unpatriotic. Well, you have to. That's another part of the mindset you have to get rid of. Because if you don't, then you think you have to wear a flag in your lapel, or you think you have to always have American flags around you, and you have to show by your love for all this meaningless paraphernalia that you are patriotic. Well, that's, you know. Oh, there too, an honest presidential candidate would not be afraid to say, you know, patriotism is not a matter of wearing a flag in your lapel, not a matter of this or matter. Patriotism is not supporting the government. Patriotism is supporting the principles that the government is supposed to stand for. You know. Yeah, so we need to redefine these things which have been thrown at us and which we've imbibed without thinking, not thinking, oh, what really is patriotism? If we start really thinking about what it is, then we will reject those cries that you're not patriotic, and we'll say, patriotism is not supporting the government. When the government does bad things, the most patriotic thing you can do is to criticize the government, because that's the Declaration of Independence. That's our basic democratic charter. The Declaration of Independence says governments are set up by the people to, they're artificial creations. They're set up to ensure certain rights, the equal right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So when governments become destructive of those ends, the Declaration said, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. That's our basic democratic charter. People have forgotten what it is. It's okay to alter or abolish the government when the government violates its trust. And then you are being patriotic. And when the government violates its trust, the government is being unpatriotic. So, yeah. Yeah, so we have to think about these, you know, these words and phrases that are thrown at us without giving us a time to think. And, you know, we have to redefine these words, like, you know, national security. What is national security? Well, you say, well, this is for national security. Oh, that takes care of it. No, it doesn't take care of it. National security means different things to different people. There's some people, national security means having military bases all over the world. For other people, national security means having health care, having jobs. You know, that's security. You know. We need to sort of redefine these things. You know, we need to redefine terrorism. Otherwise, you know, otherwise the government can throw these words at us. Oh, we're fighting against terrorism. Oh, well, then I guess we have to do this. Wait a while. What do you mean by terrorism? We sort of have an idea what terrorism means. Terrorism means that you kill innocent people for some belief that you have. Yeah, blowing up at 9/11, yet I was terrorist. But if that's the definition of terrorism, killing innocent people for some belief they have, then war is terrorism. You say. So we have to change our mindset. We have to stop thinking that solutions to problems are military solutions, that you can solve problems with violence. You can't really, don't really solve problems with violence. We have to change our definitions of heroism. Heroism in American culture so far, really, when people think of heroism, they think of military heroes. They think of the people, those whose statues are all over the country, you know. And they think of medals and battles. And, yeah, these are military heroes. And that's why Obama goes along with that definition of military, of hero, by referring to John McCain, you know, as a military hero, always feeling that he must do that. I never felt he must do that. John McCain, to my mind, and I know this is a tough thing to accept and may make some people angry, John McCain was tortured and bore up under torture and was a victim of torture and imprisonment and, you know, takes fortitude to do that. He's not a military hero. Before he was imprisoned, he dropped bombs on innocent people. He did what the other members of the Air Force did. They dropped bombs on peasant villages and killed a lot of innocent people. I don't consider that heroism. So we have to redefine. To me, the great heroes are the people who have spoken out against war. Those are the heroes, you know. Yeah, I think we have to change our mindset. We have to understand certain things that we haven't maybe thought about enough. I think one of the things we haven't thought about enough, because this is basic and this is crucial, we haven't realized, or at least not expressed it consciously, that the government's interests are not the same as our interests, really. And so when they talk about the national interest, they're creating what Kurt Vonnegut used to call a grand falloon. A grand falloon was so a meaningless abstraction in which you put things together that don't belong together, you see, a national security. National interest. No, there's no one national interest. There's the interest of the President of the United States, and then the interest of the young person he sends to war. They're different interests, you see. No, there's the interest of Exxon and Halliburton, and there's the interest of the worker, the nurse's aide, the teacher, the factory worker. Those are different interests. Once you recognize that you and the government have different interests, that's a very important step forward in your thinking, because if you think you have a common interest with the government, well, then it means that if the government says you must do this and you must do that and it's a good idea to go to war here, well, the government is looking out for my interest. No, the government is not looking out for your interest. The government has its own interests, and they're not the interests of the people. Not just true in the United States, it's true everywhere in the world. Governments generally do not represent the interests of their people. See? That's why governments keep getting overthrown. Because people at a certain point realize, hey, no, the government is not serving my interests. That's also why governments lie. Why do governments lie? And you know, you must know that governments lie. Not just our government, governments in general lie. Why do they lie? They have to lie. Because their interests are different than the interests of ordinary people. If they told the truth, they would be out of office. So, you know, have to recognize, you know, that the difference in interest.